Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, November 3, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the State Farm case and the False Claims Act. This case argued Tuesday in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guest Corey Andrews. He's the Senior Litigation Counsel at the Washington Legal Foundation. He's going to begin by giving us some background on the case and then talking about the oral argument. His opening remarks will be about 15 or 20 minutes, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions. Mr. Corey Andrews, your opening thoughts.
Thank you very much, Dean. So State Farm X Rel Rigsby is a case brought under the False Claims Act, and for those who may be unfamiliar with it, the False Claims Act imposes liability on persons and companies who defraud the federal government. The Act's key TAM provisions allow private individuals with knowledge of fraud perpetrated against the government to bring suit in the name of the government. So they're literally standing in the shoes of the government. The government then receives notice of the suit, and it can intervene if it wishes to and take over the litigation. Now, to incentivize these key TAM relators to come forward and to expose fraud, the Act authorizes a bounty of up to 30% on all recoveries and has a provision for attorney's fees as well. So by way of background, the relators in this case, Corey and Carrie Rigsby, are former claims adjusters who provided third-party services to State Farm. They allege that State Farm submitted a false claim to the federal government's flood insurance program in connection with a Biloxi, Mississippi homeowners policy claim in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. According to the Rigsby's, State Farm instructed claims adjusters to mischaracterize wind damage caused by Hurricane Katrina, which would be covered under State Farm's homeowners policy, as flood damage covered by the National Flood Insurance Program. Now, among other things, the False Claim Act's key TAM provision requires that a relator's complaint shall be filed in camera and shall remain under seal for at least 60 days until the court orders the complaint to be served against the defendant. That gives the government time to conduct its own investigation, and the government can obtain an additional extension of the 60-day period, as it did in this case, while it continues its investigation. The statute does not provide what consequence, if any, should follow a relator's violation of that seal requirement. And the circuits are split as to whether the suit must be dismissed automatically if the seal is violated, which is a rule that the Sixth Circuit has adopted, or whether some sort of balancing test considering various factors should be entrusted to the court's discretion. And so that is actually the question presented in this case, where the Rigsby's and their attorney repeatedly violated the seal requirement by notifying news organizations and others about the existence and nature of their key TAM suit. Specifically, the Rigsby's attorney hired a prominent Washington, D.C.-based public relations firm to disclose the details of their suit to national media outlets, including ABC, CBS, the Associated Press, and the New York Times, resulting in nationwide print and television coverage. The Rigsby sisters and their attorney also met with their congressman, who publicly excoriated State Farm from the well of the House, making its way into the congressional record. And then they disclosed the existence of the key TAM suit itself at a meeting of the House Oversight Investigations Committee. Their congressman, rather, disclosed the existence at a committee meeting. So on the basis of all of these seal violations, State Farm moved unsuccessfully below to dismiss the suit. The district court went on to award the Rigsby's 30% of more than $750,000 award against State Farm and $2.9 million in attorney's fees and costs. So the Fifth Circuit affirmed the district court's refusal to dismiss the relator's claims. And in doing so, it borrowed a balancing test from the Ninth Circuit, and it held that because State Farm had not been able to show that the seal violation hampered in any way the government's investigation, that no dismissal was warranted. The panel even said, if we presume bad faith on the part of the respondents, we conclude that because the government was not harmed, the fundamental purpose of the seal requirement was not undermined. So State Farm urges the Supreme Court to adopt the Sixth Circuit's bright-line automatic dismissal rule for key TAM seal violations, and it points to the text and the structure of the statute to argue that the seal requirement really operates as a mandatory precondition to suit. The Act states that the complaint shall be filed in camera and shall remain under seal, making the maintenance of the seal mandatory, not permissive. And in the alternative, State Farm says even if dismissal is discretionary and not mandatory, that to allow this suit to proceed, despite the relator's egregious and willful and bad faith seal violations, would be effectively to write the seal requirements out of the statute. And so State Farm urges the court that when it adopts a balancing test, that any balancing test should consider bad faith and the severity of the violation as sort of the primary factors. In response, the relators in this case argue that nothing in the statute specifies the consequence or remedy for a seal violation, which leaves the matter entirely to the broad discretion of the district court. So it was not an abuse of discretion in this case for the district court to decline State Farm's request to dismiss the relators in a case where no harm to the government ever occurred. Seal violations occur, they say, in less than 0.5% of all FCA cases. And because the whole point of the key TAM provision is to empower private plaintiffs to punish fraud, dismissal of a meritorious key TAM action would permit a windfall for the defendant while allowing fraud against the government to go unpunished. Now, the Solicitor General also appeared as an amicus in the case to express the view of the United States. And so the government agrees that with the relators that by failing to specify a penalty, Congress intended for the enforcement of key TAM seals, like, you know, all seals and protective orders, to be left to the discretion of district judges. And again, because the key TAM seal exists to protect the integrity of the government's investigation, it's harm to the government that it seems to be key. And since the government was not prejudiced here by the seal violation, there is no abuse of discretion. Now, at the same time, the government concedes that it would not have been an abuse of discretion had the district court dismissed the relator's case, but that the court simply was not obliged to do so. And the government also agrees with State Farm that harm to the defendant could also be an appropriate consideration to take into account in any balancing test. So oral argument in the case was held on Tuesday. I've had the pleasure of attending dozens of Supreme Court arguments, and this one was really one of the most effectively argued cases I've ever seen on both sides. Kathleen Sullivan of Quinn Emanuel argued on behalf of State Farm. Tejinder Singh of Goldstein and Russell argued on behalf of the relators, and John Bash appeared on behalf of the United States. Unlike many oral arguments, there were no factions or sort of voting blocks that were readily apparent from the questioning. In fact, there seemed to be a fair amount of like-mindedness among the justices based on all of their questions. None of the justices seemed particularly eager or likely to adopt the automatic per se dismissal rule urged by State Farm, in part because many seal violations they thought may be inadvertent or trivial or just otherwise de minimis. And although Kathleen Sullivan conceded that they could certainly create a de minimis exception, no justice showed much interest in that idea. But at the same time, many justices made it clear that they are not entirely sanguine about what happened in this case. I thought Kathleen Sullivan did a good job of rebutting any suggestion that a key TAM defendant receives an automatic windfall anytime the relator's claims are dismissed. As she pointed out, under the statute, the government can always intervene at any time, even after dismissal. And by statute, its case will always relate back to the time of the filing of the original complaint. So there's never any statute of limitations problem. And so there really doesn't need to be any fear of windfall in a case where the government believes that it has actually been defrauded. And she reminded the court that, incidentally, in this case, the government's own investigation found no evidence that wind damage had been falsely attributed to flood damage by State Farm or that flood insurance ever paid for wind damage. She also argued that affirming the Fifth Circuit in this case would send a clear message to key TAM seal violators to just go ahead and leak away. And Justice Breyer in particular certainly seemed to take that concern very seriously. And he noted several times throughout oral argument that it's not just the government that has a very real interest in ensuring that the seals are honored, but that the judiciary, after all, seals are the creatures of court orders. The judiciary and the integrity of the judiciary itself has an interest that court orders are not so breezily ignored like they were in this case. Ms. Sullivan also made a compelling case that any harm resulting from the seal violation should be evaluated ex ante at the time of the violation and not ex post, as the Fifth Circuit did in this case. She said it should be of no benefit to the relators if no harm ultimately occurs. And using a metaphor, she said, we don't let drug dealers off if the thing they think is marijuana that they are selling turns out to be oregano. What matters is your state of mind at the time of the violation. Some justices were concerned with nailing down just how much weight the government's view as to the propriety of dismissal should be afforded. No one called for any kind of Chevron-type deference, but if the seal exists primarily for the benefit of the government, shouldn't the government's view be dispositive? Or at least if there is a multi-factor test, shouldn't that be the heavily weighted factor? State Farm pointed out, though, that the government practically never claims that it's actually been injured. In fact, there appears to have only been one instance since the QI-TAM provision was enacted in which the government ever actually asserted that it had sustained harm from a seal violation. The government proposed a test in which the court would defer to the government on the question of actual harm, but could still nevertheless weigh the potential for harm in considering the severity of the violation. And so in sum, the court appears unlikely to adopt the Sixth Circuit's bright line dismissal rule, but it's clear that the court is struggling with exactly how to balance all of the equities in articulating a multi-factor test in a way that makes the most sense.
Well, thank you very much. It's an interesting case. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. A couple of business announcements here. The Federalist Society National Lawyers Convention is 2 weeks from today. It begins. Registration is open on the Federalist Society's webpage. If you would like to register to attend the convention, go there and click through. In terms of our upcoming schedule for telephone conference calls, tomorrow at noon, Eastern Time at the same number, we'll be talking about voting in Guam.
While we're waiting for calls, maybe I can just make a couple more comments about the False Claims Act and why this case is significant. So I think to fully appreciate the larger context of the significance of the False Claims Act in this case, it's important to note that litigation under the Act has exploded in recent years. Again, the False Claims Act provides for treble damages, mandatory minimum penalties, and the recovery of costs, including attorney's fees, making it quite lucrative and therefore attractive for plaintiff's attorneys. So as a result, the False Claims Act is particularly vulnerable to abuse, and government contractors have complained bitterly about what they view as unduly lax application of the statute by the lower courts. And it's usually only a very, very small percentage of QI-TAM actions in which the government ultimately decides to intervene, suggesting, at least from the government's perspective, things that relators are calling fraud are not necessarily fraud. And it just so happens the stakes are higher now than ever before because this August, the fines under the False Claims Act nearly doubled, with the minimum penalty rising from $5,500 to over $10,000 per claim. And the maximum penalty is now increased from $11,000 to just under $22,000 per claim. So that's a little more context and why this case matters and why the False Claims Act has been getting so much attention lately.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. I was sorry, Corey, I was disconnected from my own call, but I am back now. Let me make a quick business announcement before we turn to audience questions. By the way, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Our registration for the National Lawyers Convention is also open. That convention begins 2 weeks from today. If you're interested in attending, you need to get registered at the Federal Society's website. In terms of our schedule for upcoming Teleforum conference calls, tomorrow at noon we'll be talking about voting in Guam. That's tomorrow at noon at the same number. The question there is whether or not you must be a native of Guam in order to vote in the upcoming election. So an interesting question. Today, of course, we're talking about the False Claims Act and the State Farm case. Let me ask you, since you attended the argument, were there any issues that you didn't hear at oral argument that you expected to hear based on what you saw in the briefs or other expectations? And before you answer, let me just remind folks to push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question. But with that, Corey Andrews.
Yeah, actually, one of the more interesting points that didn't really come out in oral argument, but that was covered fairly thoroughly in the briefs and in the amicus briefs in support of State Farm is that any balancing test should take into account the harm to a defendant's reputation that can result from these kinds of improper disclosures. You know, even in cases where a defendant believes they have legally compelling defense on the merits, it's the risk of astronomical liability, no matter how remote, that often can provide a strong motivation to settle these types of claims. And so if you allow QTAM relators to violate the seal, the sort of public relations leverage that creates provides relators and their counsel with the ability to force defendants into settlements, even in, you know, the most frivolous claims. And although, you know, State Farm didn't settle, this is substantial risk of harm to a defendant's reputation, I think, it is vividly illustrated by this case where the respondents' calculated media campaign to vilify State Farm resulted in an avalanche of unfavorable publicity that, you know, was undeniably damaging to State Farm's reputation. And unlike State Farm, a lot of QTAM defendants don't have the luxury or the resources to litigate their case all the way up to the Supreme Court. And so I think that sort of larger context is important here.
What, if you know, what's a remedy typical for a court to impose on a party for violating a seal? Is dismissal a common remedy in other sorts of cases?
There aren't a lot of these. There have not been a lot of these cases in the Sixth Circuit. That is the mandatory remedy, and I think that's happened, you know, more maybe half a dozen times or so.
So I meant in.
But in terms of the range of remedies, I mean, if ultimately which I think it will do, the court rejects the per se automatic dismissal rule, it will provide the district court with a range of remedies or sanctions in its discretion, and so that could be a monetary fine. It could be a decrease in the amount of the relator's bounty. It could be, if it involves attorney misconduct, it could involve disbarment. You know, there are any range of remedies that could fit a particular case, and we've seen examples of those sorts of things in QTAM cases before.
And in other litigation of other types, how often is it the case that a court will impose a sanction of dismissal of a case for violating a court order? If you know, I mean, that's a pretty broad question, but dismissal to many might seem like a pretty severe sanction for violating the court's order.
Well, it's a severe sanction, but again, two points, I guess. One, it only these sorts of seal violations don't come up very often, and they don't happen very often. And the argument is that if dismissal is a sanction or a likely sanction, you'll see a lot less of these seal violations than more of them. And the other point is it is severe as to these particular relators, but it doesn't allow sort of bad actors to get off scot-free because, again, the government can always intervene at any time, even after dismissal of the case, and prosecute the case. So there's always the government, and since, again, they're standing in the shoes of the government in the first place, they should be held to a higher standard is the argument.
Right. Once again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. You mentioned, I want to pick up on one thing you mentioned in your opening remarks, and that's about the argument that the court itself or the process itself is injured to the extent a party violates a court order. In other words, the court has an interest here. How much emphasis do you think or how much play do you think that might get in the court's decision? How parochial is that interest going to weigh in the court's decision?
I think there was a broad consensus on the part of many justices, and most vocal, again, was Justice Breyer, that you know the facts in this case are so egregious and the violation is so blatant that to allow it to just be passed without any sanction whatsoever would undermine the integrity of the courts. And so Justice Breyer actually made a point of putting that question and that concern to all three attorneys during oral argument, attorney on behalf of State Farm and of the relators and to the government. And of course, no one was really in a position to argue in favor of disregarding court orders. And so I think, again, if the court decides to reverse and remand in this case, which I think is likely, I think that will be one of the primary, motivating factors, is that we can't just have open season on disregarding court orders that doesn't further the interest of justice for anyone.
Interesting. Let me make another call for questions. I think we're coming to our final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. We do have a question now, so let's turn to our first audience member of the day.
Hi. I got in a little bit late, so I'm not quite sure where you're coming from, whether or not you're in favor of the sanctions of dismissal of the complaint for breach of the seal violation, or could go one way or the other on it. But quite frankly, it seems to me one of the most telling issues against sort of the death penalty dismissal of the complaint is the fact the government was on the side of the relator in this case. They were not upset by the seal violation, and in fact, as the argument flowed, as at least I understand it, that was one of the concerns of the justices. How the seal violation issue is there to protect the government and the integrity of its sort of, if you will, undercover, under seal investigation. If the government is not upset by the seal violation, how could anybody else be upset for it? How would you respond to that?
Yeah, thank you. That's right. Justice Roberts and also Justice Ginsburg certainly indicated their view that the seal exists for the government. It seems to be if the government isn't harmed or doesn't feel like dismissal is mandated, that should be the end of it. A couple of points in response to that I think come from the other side. One of them is the one that we've been talking about, which is that the one Justice Breyer brought out, which is that it's not only the government that has a concern that the seal be maintained. The judiciary has a concern in the integrity of its court orders and that its court orders not be disregarded. The other point that Kathleen Sullivan brought out is to the extent that that you're going to require actual harm to the government before a case can be dismissed. The government has almost never claimed that it's harmed. We've only found one case since the commencement of the QI-TAM action in which the government says we've actually been harmed. And so that seems to be a kind of a steep burden and to put on, you know, on a defendant if that's the burden that has to be met to get a dismissal. I would also just point out that the government itself said that there would not have been an abuse of discretion in this case had the district court dismissed the relator suit, that it would have been perfectly free to do so. They just maintained that it wasn't obligated to do so and that it certainly wasn't an abuse of discretion not to. Since you're coming in a little bit late to the call, I'll just point out, I don't think that there was any indication that the court is likely to adopt the Sixth Circuit's automatic dismissal rule. Rather, I think it's pretty clear that they're struggling right now to figure out the best way to balance all the equities and whether or not to apply them in this case to these facts.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the way it should come down. One other comment, if I could, the idea of that there's no harm, no foul if the QI-TAM action is dismissed because the government can always intervene and pursue the lawsuit, that doesn't happen very often, 1 in 20 or something, and there are lots of reasons for that. Some of them are actually political. The government doesn't want to take on a favored defendant in a given arena. And when you are faced with issues like original source and other related doctrines which stand for the proposition that these are the only relators that can bring this lawsuit, there's nobody else to do it in most cases. That would be that's a comment rather than an argument, but maybe you have some thoughts on that.
Sure. I mean, again, these sorts of violations themselves don't occur very often. Another reason, of course, that you left out that the government might not want to intervene is that they didn't find any fraud and that they concluded they weren't defrauded. And that happens in a lot of cases as well. Also, you know, after the Kellogg-Brown Xrel Carter decision that came out, my understanding is that where there is a kind of procedural dismissal, that a second filed relator, assuming there are no statute of limitations problem, could come and stand in the shoes of the government in a case in which the first file relator has been dismissed. I'm not entirely positive about that, but my perfunctory reading of the case suggests that's at least an open question.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. I think you have to be an original source. Would you not agree?
Well, you have to be an original source, but that's different. That's different than a first filer, first to file. They may be using the same original source, but not, you know, be the second person to file, so to speak. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We do have another question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
Hi, I also missed your opening remarks, so I apologize if this question may have already been addressed. But are there any First Amendment defenses being raised by the relators? And secondly, are there any implications in this case for public interest firms or other attorneys that tend to publicize the filing of their lawsuits with a lot of fanfare?
Yeah, that's a great question. The issue came up very tangentially at argument, and it comes up naturally in the context of what constitutes a violation of the seal. And so the statute itself says that the complaint shall remain under seal. But the courts have sort of uniformly said, well, if the existence of the suit is known, that basically performs the same function as disclosing the complaint. It puts the world and potentially the defendant on notice. And so then the question that has First Amendment implications is, well, is it a violation if you don't talk about the suit or you don't talk about the fact that there's a court proceeding, but you just talk about the underlying bad conduct? And I think Justice Kennedy and probably most of the justices on the court see that there are obviously First Amendment implications to how broadly a seal violation is defined. I believe the Fourth Circuit, there's a panel opinion in the Fourth Circuit that says sort of unequivocally that apart from the existence of the suit, relators have the same First Amendment freedoms as anyone else has to talk about facts that they're privy to. And so in this case, that's really not presented, because what the attorneys did in this case was they took the evidentiary disclosure that's attached to the complaint, which at the very top of it has the style of the case, and it has served on the United States, and makes it very clear that it's a key TAM action, and likewise the congressman that they met with also made it very clear that it was a key TAM action. And so they're not that's one reason why this case is a nice vehicle, is it really doesn't run afoul of the First Amendment concerns. I wouldn't be surprised to see, at least in a footnote in the court's decision, a reminder to all the courts that there are First Amendment protections that exist, and that would limit the court's ability to punish relators for communicating truthfully about the facts that they're aware of.
Thanks.
Let me make another call for questions. This is perhaps your last chance to ask a question. Push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question. Looks like we've had our final question of the day. Let me revert to you, Corey, and see if you have a final thought you want to express. Corey Andrews.
Thank you, Dean, and thanks for everyone that called in today. Listen, the key TAM provision of the False Claims Act is an interesting statute. It's been seeing a lot of use in recent years, and I think the court's interest is in this case is going to be to arriving at just the right balance to balance the defendant's interest and not being forced into a settlement through public relations pressure and the government's interest in proceeding against fraud and being able to conduct its own investigation. As I've said throughout the call, there's certainly a case to be made that the statute could be read to require automatic dismissal, and I think State Farm made that case as forcefully as they could. But if I had to guess what the court would do based on oral arguments, I think it's much more likely that the court will will not cabin the discretion of district courts and will rather articulate some sort of balancing test that arrives at the proper balance of competing interests.
Very good. Let me join you in thanking the audience. And I want to thank you, too, of course, Corey Andrews. Thanks so much for your presentation, for attending oral argument, and for giving us your thoughts. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call tomorrow at noon. We'll be talking about voting in Guam. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.